I told you that I want to go to that festival in Sweden.
Oh, you said it would be cool to go.
Yeah, and then I got the opportunity and I decided
Look,
to do it.
I don't mind you going. I just wish you would have told me, that's all.
Dude, she needs a therapist. You've been wanting out of this stupid relationship for like a year now.
And don't forget about all of the beautiful Swedish women you'll meet in June.
Okay, guys.
That's not her again. Seriously?
Babe, what's happening? Danny.
I was so very sorry to hear about what happened.
I'm sorry.
I invited Danny to come to Sweden.
You know what she's been going through?
Christian says you've got this special week planned.
It's sort of a crazy festival. Special ceremonies and dressing up.
That sounds fun.
Unbelievable.
Welcome and happy midsummer. Skål!
What time is it?
9 p.m.
That can't be right. The sky is blue.
This is what 9 p.m. is like here.
How long have you two been together?
Just over 3.5 years.
4 years.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you think?
It's like another world.
Tomorrow's a big day.
Is it scary?
What is it?
It has special properties.
What am I going through?
We just need to acclimate.
I don't want
to
acclimate, I want to go.
Absolutely not.
What's happening? I don't know why you invited us.
That's why you look so guilty right now, because you know.
We only do this every 90 years.
I was most excited for you to come.
Greetings, dear listener, and welcome back to another and long overdue episode of the Warehouse Podcast. I'm your friendly neighborhood podcaster, Aaron Escobar, coming to you from sunny Culver City, California, the original home of Hollywood. Today's episode, as mentioned previously, is one we've been eagerly anticipating discussing since we first launched the podcast back in 2020. Yes, it's been almost 3 years since we've done this, and I think to date we have roughly 61 episodes. So that's a pretty good, you know, metric, I would say. Obviously, we skipped most of 2022, so I don't think we're really going to count that one. But we're back in the swing of things, so hey, 61 episodes. Hopefully, we can get to 100. However, at that time, it still felt too recent, and certain aspects of my life had yet undergone fundamental changes to discuss this film. But after losing my best friend, Ricardo Sandoval, my father, Peter Escobar Jr., my grandmother, Marguerite Rodriguez, and my long-term partner of 6 years, all within less than 2 years during the pandemic, this film has taken on a more, I want to say, profound meaning for me than when I first watched it in cinemas in 2019. I am, of course, talking about Ari Aster's magnificent millennial response to The Wicker Man, the sun-drenched horror of Midsommar. Not going to lie, I had a hard time watching this film with my ex when I first saw it in theaters back in 2019. I actually think I saw it at the ArcLight Theater in Culver City, California, which has long since closed and is now just called the Culver Theater, and it's owned by Amazon. It's a long, complex story about the ArcLight. I used to work for it back in 2018. Maybe I'll do an episode on reminiscing about ArcLight cinema. But I watched it at the ArcLight, and I, in a weird way, this is one of those films that actually feels more impersonal in cinemas than it does on a home screen. I think the intimacy of watching it at home actually drives home the meaning of this film a lot more than watching it on the silver screen in a movie theater. It sounds very weird because there are very few films where I would say it's, I don't want to say anti-cinematic, because it is incredibly a cinematic film. It is gorgeous to look at. The cinematography is magnificent. there are so many aspects, from color design to cinematography to camera movement to performance to costume design to music, especially the music, that just work on all levels for this film. Maybe I need to watch it again in theaters to sort of get a better understanding of what it feels like to see it again in cinemas, because it has been so long. But over the past, I think, 4 years now since this film came out, almost five at this point, I've watched it, you know, back home on my personal, you know, TV in a more intimate environment. And that seems a little bit more profound and impactful than I think going to a cinema would be again. But maybe I might go watch it again. It is coming out on October 25th. A24 is doing a limited release again of Midsommar for Halloween. So maybe if I have a little extra cash, I probably will go check it out to just experience it again, to see it on the big screen, because it has been so long since I've done that. So who knows? I could be wrong in my assumption, my feeling, but, you know, I'm open to going to watch it again in theaters. I think that would be ideal if I could. Starring, of course, the magnificent and beautiful Florence Pugh as Dani. I've loved her. This is the film that got me into Florence Pugh. Well, that and Don't Worry, Darling, which is a hit or miss. I'll probably cover that film at a later date, because I have a very deep conflicted feelings over Olivia Munn's Don't Worry, Darling. I think there's wasted potential in that film, especially with Florence Pugh. Even Olivia wasn't terrible in it. I just don't think, as a sophomore outing, you should go from, you know, Booksmart, which is a wonderful coming-of-age Gen Z film, to Don't Worry, Darling, which is this very almost homage to films like The Stepford Wives and Rosemary's Baby. It just didn't really work with her as a director. But Florence Pugh is amazing in it. Florence Pugh is amazing in Oppenheimer. Florence Pugh is amazing in Macbeth. Florence Pugh is just amazing in everything she does, because she's Florence Pugh, and she is beautiful and magnificent and just sweet. And I feel like I would get along with Florence Pugh, but that kind of goes back to the parasocial relationships I was talking about last week with X. Jack Rayner as Christian. Will Poulter as Mark. William Jackson Harper as Josh. And William Blogman as Pelle, their Swedish exchange student from college that takes them to Hesgard to, you know, go through the 90-year Midsommar Festival. I actually really love his performance in this film. It is so empathetic and it's so compassionate, and it's so not what Dani, Christian, Mark, and Josh are like. Dani, Christian, Mark, and Josh are very restrained, very conservative, in the sense of just sort of being brainwashed by very modern Western ideology of conservating, of basically playing your emotions close to your chest, not allowing yourself to express yourself as you wish to be expressed, right? And are essentially just selfish Westerners, whereas Pelle, yes, he's a Westerner because it's Sweden and has Western aspects, but he comes from such a radically different perspective of life, radically different upbringing, radically different perspective on how to be a person and how to form a society and how to function in a society that is essentially a collective commune, that his performance is actually very sweet and feels genuine and feels very empathetic. And I think he's probably, up until the very end, is probably the most likable character in this film, which sounds very odd because he is a member of a cult, but his performance is so endearing and so sweet that I actually kind of want Dani and Pelle to date towards the end of this movie. It feels like they're more suited as a couple than Christian and Dani are. And, you know, I feel like either consciously or subconsciously, that was a choice by Ari Aster to hint at that dynamic probably being a better suit for Dani than Christian is. Could be wrong, could just be a misinterpretation on my part, but I do feel like there is some, if not romantic hint, at least a deep compassion understanding of who Dani is from Pele's aspect. So, you know, if not a romantic relationship, at least a platonic relationship based off of mutual understanding and empathy, which sometimes is probably more needed in our lives than romance. There are certain relationships in our lives, certain friendships, I would say, that are just better left as friendships more so than anything else, because there is this platonic relationship and understanding with each other that, you know, even if we could work out as a couple, would we really want to risk that? Would we really want to risk that dynamic? And I'm sure we've all had relationships that are very similar in that regards of a complete mutual understanding of someone, empathy with someone, but never really crossing that line into a full-blown romantic relationship. And I do feel that with Pele and Danny. Again, could be wrong, could be Ari Aster's sort of interpretation of that sort of relationship, but who knows? It's just how I tend to read that relationship in that film. Sorry, if you're hearing little, like, munching noises, it's Luna, my black cat, named after Sailor Moon, of course, digging into her dinner. I try to record these podcasts pretty late at night. Never really succeeds because, well, I have cats, and cats are noisy, and they work on cat time. But American studie Danny is left deeply traumatized after her bipolar sister, Carrie, kills their parents and herself. The incident further strains Danny's relationship with her increasingly distant boyfriend, a fellow student named Christian. She later learns that Christian, with his friends Mark and Josh, have been invited by their Swedish friend Pele to attend a midsummer festival at his ancestral commune, the Herga, in a rural Hälsingland. Sorry, it's Swedish, and I do not speak Swedish. And I'm pretty sure if I took shroom tea and danced around a flower pole, I might speak Swedish, as Danny does towards the end of the film, but I do not right now. The festival occurs only once every 90 years. Josh, who is writing his thesis on European midsummer festivals, regards it as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Christian had not discussed this trip with Danny, as he intended to break up with her before her family tragedy happened, but he reluctantly invites her along after an argument. Upon arrival at the commune, they meet Simon and Connie, a British couple who were invited by Pele's commune brother, Ingmar. I did say his name correctly, though. He offers the group psychedelic mushrooms, causing Danny to have a bad trip and hallucinate about her dead family. The day after their arrival, the group witnesses an Ættersplupad ceremony whose two elders commit suicide by jumping from a... I'm sorry, I had to laugh because as I'm trying to record this deeply, like, you know, intense plot line, my cat decided to pee. So I'm sorry, I'm not going to re-record this because I like the spontaneity of it and God knows what else I'll do. But yes, I had to bring that up. Whose two elders commit suicide by jumping from a cliff onto the rocks below. When one of the elders survives the fall, the commune members mimic his wails of pain before crushing his head with a large mallet. Commune elder Siv attempts to calm Connie and Simon by explaining that every member of their community does this at the age of 72 and that it is believed to be a great honor. Christian also decides to write his thesis on the Herga commune, irritating Josh by plagiarizing his idea. Disturbed by the ceremonies, Danny attempts to leave, but Pele convinces her to stay. He explains that he, too, was orphaned after his parents perished in a fire, and that the commune became his new family. Connie and Simon demand to leave and are supposedly driven to a nearby train station individually. During his thesis research, Christian is told that outsiders are sometimes brought into the commune for mating purposes to avoid incest. He is encouraged to participate but refuses. After unwittingly urinating on a sacred tree, Mark is lured away from the group by one of the female commune members and murdered in the woods. That night, Josh sneaks out of bed to take illicit photos of the commune's sacred texts. He is caught and distracted by a man wearing Mark's skinned face and is then bludgeoned to death with a mallet and dragged away, which I think is probably the most indirect film reference this film has. Obviously, there is the vaguely indirect reference to films like, say, The Wicker Man from 1973, which I think is an entirely different film than Midsommar. They share very surface level similarities. You know, outsiders go to this isolated commune to witness horrific acts of violence and sacrifices, ending with one of them burning alive in an effigy, in the case of The Wicker Man, you know, a literal giant wicker man, and in the case of Midsommar, a beautiful sort of wooden pyramid structure that is painted like the sun. But there are surface level elements for The Wicker Man in Midsommar, which I don't really want to compare and contrast because they're very distinctly different films with different themes and motives and just styles. But I would say that face mask scene is probably Ari Aster's most direct cinema reference to clearly the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because it is pretty horrific. And, you know, you're watching it and that scene pops up and you're like, oh, okay, this is a very clear cinematic reference. Probably the clearest one in the film. I don't think this film references a lot of other films. A lot of the thesis and themes of this film are entirely its own, which I actually greatly appreciate. And I think this is how Midsommar stands apart from films like Hereditary, which I will get into later on the podcast, because frankly, I do not care for Hereditary as much as I do for Midsommar. The following day, both Danny and Christian are separately pressured into taking hallucinogens, tea. Danny wins a maypole dancing competition and is crowned the May Queen. Christian is drugged and participates in a sex ritual designed to impregnate Maya, a young member of the Herga, while older nude female members watch and mimic Maya's moans. Danny witnesses the ritual and has a panic attack while the commune's women surround her, mimicking her cries of sorrow. After the ritual, a nude Christian attempts to flee. He discovers Josh's severed head, severed legs planted in a flower bed, and Simon's corpse on display in a barn, and later having been made into a blood eagle. An elder then paralyzes Christian with a drug. For the final ceremony, the commune leaders explain that the commune must offer 9 human sacrifices to purge it of evil. The first 4 victims, Mark, Josh, Simon, and Connie, were outsiders lured to them by Pelle and Ingmar, while the next 4 victims, the 2 Atisopos elders, plus volunteers Ingmar and Ulf, are from the commune. As the May Queen, Danny must choose either a Christian or a randomly chosen commune member as the final sacrifice. She chooses Christian, and rightfully so, because he's a douchebag, who is stuffed into a disemboweled brown bear's body and placed into a triangular wooden temple alongside the other sacrifices. The commune members to be sacrificed are given drugs and told they will feel no fear or pain, but Christian is not, and remains paralyzed. The structure is set ablaze, and the commune members mimic the screams of those being burned alive. Danny initially sobs in horror and grief, but eventually begins to smile, having succumbed to the madness. And, of course, it is perfectly encapsulated by "The sun ain't gonna shine no more," which I think was the best song choice for end credits probably in cinema history. You can argue with me with that. I don't care. I actually do think Aster is probably got great taste in music, because this song just works so perfectly with "The sun ain't gonna shine anymore," juxtaposed to the fact that there is the midnight sun in Sweden during the summer months. And you know, "The sun ain't gonna shine no more" is essentially a 60s breakup song, but juxtaposed to that song is Danny sort of finding happiness and joy that she broke up with her deadbeat boyfriend. And again, rightfully so, because Christian is a douchebag. He's an insensitive, indifferent, uncaring, you know, asshole who only stuck with Danny through the course of the film because she was going through the grieving process of losing her family, but she wasn't even really permitted to grieve during the course of, you know, her coming to terms with that loss. She is seen multiple times throughout the film sort of holding back her tears and holding back her anxieties and holding back her panic, so that way she isn't burdensome or a bore or a drag to the people around her. She isn't permitted to express that emotion in any sort of healthy, meaningful, cathartic way. She is told to either, I don't think told, but she feels that sort of social pressure of having it together, of maintaining herself, of not breaking down in public, of not breaking down in tears. And you can only really do that for so long. And of course, we'll get into this in the next segment of the podcast, but you can only really do that for so long as a person before it all boils to the surface. And it can either be very constructive and very cathartic, or very deconstructive and very toxic, depending on how you process your grief and if you feel like you're allowed to process your grief. Processing your grief is one thing, but being allowed to express it openly is something entirely different. You know, we all process our grief. Very few of us are permitted to externalize it, right? Very few of us are permitted to openly cry and sob. And I think that's a very, I don't know if it's a very American thing, because you do have the British sentimentality of like maintaining a stiff upper lip, right? But it is very much part of Western culture that I do think is being challenged more so now than when this film came out. You know, when this film came out in 2019, it was sort of the start of the conversation about toxic masculinity and toxic, I guess you can say toxic stoicism. It was the beginning stages of us coming to terms and awareness of it. Now, more so than ever, I think we've had these conversations before and we're aware of these conversations. And now it's a different response. It's finding how to better manage our internal grief process and how to express that grief process externally in a healthy, constructive, and inclusive manner, rather than doing what Danny does and isolate ourselves away from the world to process our grief. If that's something you need to do, that's something you need to do, obviously, but I don't necessarily think that is something we should be forced to do, if that makes sense. The sun-drenched horror of Midsommar can be summarized as both a breakup story, a Swedish folk horror slasher, and a film profoundly about dealing with grief over tremendous loss. In my view, it's a response to films like The Wicker Man by Robin Hardy and The Devils by Ken Russell, which is an amazing film if you have not seen it. Obviously, like I mentioned about The Wicker Man, it's taking a different approach to this sort of cult fear, right? It's rather than becoming a member of the cult like Danny does at the end of Midsommar, Wicker Man is more about the police officer sort of resiliently holding on to his Christian ideology while this group of pagans burn him alive. It is an entirely different approach. I think The Wicker Man is more of a response to our ongoing fears of ancient pagan and unknown paganistic ideas and rituals and beliefs versus our quote-unquote modern Judeo-Christian ideas of morality, of ethics, of how we handle nature, which I think in a Judeo-Christian sense is very isolating because we don't really worship nature. We are very destructive to the planet. Whereas paganism is more in line with nature and counters and juxtaposes Judeo-Christian beliefs, right? There are two fundamental opposing religious ideologies that we still have to deal with in our modern day. You know, these weren't things that were purged thousands of years ago. These are aspects that still live on to current day. You know, I'm neither a pagan. I am neither a Judeo-Christian. I was a former Catholic. Not anymore. I'm more agnostic leaning, but I understand the sort of fundamental fear that Christians, Catholics, and even Jewish people have against paganistic ideas, even though a vast majority of our rituals are paganistic. Easter, Christmas, you know, those are very pagan holidays. The Devils by Ken Russell is an amazing film that sort of deals with similar themes, but rather than grief, it deals with sort of temptation and how, you know, women in the Catholic Church are sort of stripped of their right to embrace their sexuality, embrace their personhood, and embrace their womanhood, kind of in the same way that Danny is sort of forced to be very, very masculine in a world that is alienating to her. Not that I think this film is imposing any sort of gender binary theme. I just think Danny is a modern woman in a world where in order to be strong, a woman sort of has to deny her womanhood and deny the ability to even express herself. And in that sense, I think The Devils and Midsommar have some similarities in terms of how women are oppressed. One being a very physical sense of open sexuality, the other one being very psychologically driven in Midsommar. In a very odd way, it also connects to, in my book at least, I haven't really seen much criticism and critique on this, but in my view, it connects very strongly to Valerie and Her Week of Wonders by Czechoslovakian New Wave filmmaker Jerome Juris. I do apologize if I am mispronouncing that. And for those of you that haven't followed up on our other episodes, I think season one, we focused on Daisies, which was Vera Shitalova's Czech New Wave film from 1966, if I remember correctly. Valerie Her Week of Wonder was 1971. So around the same time as, say, The Wicker Man, right? In fact, I think Valabrina Week of Wonders was 71, Wicker Man was like 73, and The Devils was like 74, 75. So all the films I'm talking about and comparing to Midsommar come from this very thin stretch of the 70s, 70 to 75. And I would even kind of lump in a bit of Rosemary's Baby with this in terms of just the sort of cult structure. Whereas like, Rosemary's Baby is very literal Satanists. Approach to cult and witchcraft. Midsommar is more paganistic in its basis, but I would say Valerie Her Week of Wonders is very close to Midsommar. However, well, Valerie Her Week of Wonders explores coming to terms with the beauty and horrors of girlhood, in that the main character Valerie and her Week of Wonders, if you can read into the title, goes through her first menstrual cycle and slowly starts realizing that she is now different. And the world is now treating her different because of it. So it's her at a crossroads of her life where she essentially lost her innocence and lost her girlhood and is now expected to become a woman both physically, emotionally, and socially. And so that innocence, that I guess that simplicity of life is taken away from Valerie, whereas Midsommar delves heavily into the horrors of womanhood and the crippling sense of isolation one can often feel in a cold, careless, and insensitive world. After Dani loses her family, you know, her safety net, her bedrock, her support system, everything she knew about her world previously is stripped from her, is taken from her, like Valerie, in a sense that she loses her innocence, even though she's a grown woman already. She is forced to become this self-reliant individual, even if she wasn't ready for it, right? And I think as someone that has experienced that kind of loss of a family member, of that sort of safety system, of that network, it can feel like a second coming of age. You know, you have a mental coming of age, a physical coming of age, where you are an adult and you are expected to take on more tasks and more burdens and more responsibilities, right? That's puberty, right? That's regardless of what puberty you go to, that's the expectations. For women, it is expected you should be a mother and you should bear children, right? That's a very ancient idea for womanhood. For men, it's you are now responsible for yourself and for others, and you need to find work and maintain a household and maintain standards of living. That's a very masculine and traditional sense of coming of age, right? But when you lose your parents, if you lose your family, sorry if you're hearing sirens, you know, like I have, I lost my father in 2021, and this month would have been his 66th birthday. There is a second coming of age, and that coming of age is a more mental one, where yes, when you were an adult, you always sort of knew you were on your own in this world. You always sort of knew that it's entirely up to you whether or not you eat the next day or you have shelter, right? But you always knew you had your mom and dad. You always knew, in theory, if you had a decent relationship with them, you could move back, right? That might be soul-crushing, and it is soul-crushing, I'm sure. But you always knew you had that support system, you had that network, you had your family. But when you lose that, when you lose an element of that, like I did, there is this mental coming of age where you have to accept the fact and you have to come to terms with the fact that you are, for better or worse, alone. You are all that's left of that bloodline. You carry the burden of their memory with you forever. And you're always going to be dealing with that. You're always going to be grieving that loss. There is no coming back from it. You know, you're fundamentally different. It is your second emotional puberty. You're not the same person after you lose a loved one, after you lose your parent like you were before. It's just a fact of life. You will never be the same, right? You cannot turn back that dial and turn back time and relive those moments. And, you know, speaking for someone that has gone through grief counseling and grief therapy, I think the best thing I've learned that I sort of apply to this film is that, and it's actually kind of evident, I think, through the course of the movie, is that Dani isn't grieving the loss of what was, if that makes sense. She's not grieving the loss of what her family was. She's grieving the loss of what her family could have been because she was robbed of a future with them. And I think the best sort of advice I was given by my grief therapist is that grieving someone isn't necessarily grieving the memories of them. It's grieving the fact that you will never create new memories with them. You know, for example, my father will never see me get married, never see me have a house, never see me adopt a child, never see me become a mother, never see me, you know, become successful or build a future in the film industry or even the podcast industry, for who knows. But he will never get to experience those new memories with me, right? And I've had a series of good memories over the past 2 years that I would love to share with him, but I'm never going to have that opportunity because it's just not there anymore. And I think it's very evident in Midsommar that that is the case with Dani. She isn't grieving the loss of her family of what could have been, or I'm sorry, of what was. She's grieving the loss of what could have been. Of course, this cold-hearted nature is perfectly embodied by the distant and shattered relationship between Dani and Christian, two individuals who, by all means, should have broken up years ago, let alone maintain the pretense of a relationship for over 4 years, I think it's mentioned. And, you know, not only does the douchebag Christian forget her birthday, making some sort of lame, half-hearted excuse that the time change threw him off, but he also forgets that they've been a couple for 4 years. Like, how do you forget that? 4 years is a pretty long time, especially by millennial standards. I was in a relationship for almost 7 years. By millennial standards, that's a marriage, you know? By millennial standards, 4 years is a committed relationship by that point. And he not only forgets that, but he just is so not there for her when she is going through this process. And it's only, I think, by the time the film actually kicks off when they're at the commune, it's only been 6 months between that and when she lost her parents in the beginning of the film. So, you know, it's not a long amount of time. It's not like years have gone by and she's still grieving the process. It's a fresh wound, you know. It only started probably in January, December of that year, and it's barely June. So it's still a gaping wound in her heart that she hasn't fully come to terms with, but he's acting like, oh, she should just get over it, even though she lost her mom and dad and sister, right? Like, he's kind of a dick in that way. I think Christian embodies the masculine tendency, especially in the West, to ignore, undermine, and outright reject dealing with grief, loss, and pain. He represents the old school idea of a man not being allowed to express such emotions and concepts like loss. Now, I wouldn't go so far as to say Christian exemplifies toxic masculinity, because I don't necessarily think he does. He's not like Ben Shapiro or fucking Jordan Peterson or, you know, Joe Rogan or any of the fuckwats out there that are talking about like men being able to be masculine men and embody caveman mentality, right? Christian isn't that. And in fact, I would describe him just as the typical response most men have when it comes to addressing the emotional needs of a partner or a friend or even themselves. He is socially clueless and utterly inept at expressing his emotions. This is evident in his inability to muster the courage to break up with Dani, despite wanting to do so for a year before the events of the film. So even before her parents and family, you know, completely died, he couldn't even muster the courage on his own emotional needs to break up with Dani, which, yeah, it would have been terrible, but at least you're not breaking up with her when she's going through a grieving process, having lost her whole family. He still can't even do that. And it kind of, I think, exemplifies the idea that a lot of modern relationships and a lot of modern just marriages are built on a foundation of just convenience. People aren't really willing to deal with their emotions, aren't really willing to deal with their needs in a healthy, constructive manner. They would rather just be numb to it all and just accept the fact that this is the best it's going to get. And I think if Dani and Christian were to continue down that path, if they hadn't gone to the commune, right, they would have ended up in a loveless marriage. I think that would have very clearly been their future, would be a loveless marriage. He also struggles to respond to Dani's grief over the loss of her entire family. Again, just he is inept to it. His ineptitude and lack of awareness have a ripple effect, preventing Dani from properly expressing her own pain. The film, again, underscores this in the first 15 minutes as we witness Dani's emotional breakdown after receiving the news of her family's death, with Christian offering like minimal physical comfort. I think literally what he's doing is just like stroking her hair while she's like sitting on his lap. And he's not even like comforting or consoling her or saying anything sweet. He's literally just sort of looking into empty space and wondering like, oh shit, like I kind of have to continue this relationship now, because now I don't have the opportunity to break up with her. And that's like, at the bare minimum, dude, say I love you. Say that, like, I feel something for you. You know, at the bare minimum, at least pretend to give a shit. And I think that was one of the criticisms of this film when it first came out, was that it is a loveless relationship. But that's sort of the point of the relationship, is that it is a loveless one. And how many of us have been in a loveless relationship? Coming out of my long-term one, I look back on it, and yes, it's a mixed bag of good memories and bad memories, but to be frank, you know, it was kind of a loveless relationship. It was two people constantly fighting, two people constantly at odds, two people that could not understand each other. You know, we work better now as just occasionally talking to each other over our pets, and that's it. But there was that dynamic, and I can't even really say that's a criticism of the film, because that's sort of the point of the film. Danny doesn't have anyone that empathizes with her at the start. That's literally the point of the film. I believe the horror in Midsommar originates from the dichotomy between two worlds. Our world of cold, heartless, and emotional isolation versus the cult's communal lifestyle, which involves sharing resources, food, housing, clothes, love, and emotional support. One can argue that the latter is more a natural way to structure our existence, being close to nature, being close to our fellow human being, being empathetic to our fellow human being, which, you know, empathy seems to be a very hot button issue in modern society now, when it really fucking shouldn't be. However, from the perspective of a privileged capitalist, such a situation might seem almost horrifying due to the lack of privacy, ownership, and wealth accumulation. As Pele describes, it's a world where no one has to experience loss, a world where nobody disputes what belongs to them. And unfortunately, that's a world I'm all too familiar with people fighting over concepts like houses and land ownership and fucking, you know, deeds and property and just the accumulation of wealth. And frankly, that's something I've experienced on both sides of my lineage, more so on my paternal side. You know, I don't have any relationship now with my father's sister, her husband, my cousins. You know, they're just perfect strangers to me at this point. I think I have not talked to any of them since my father passed away in 2021, so going on a little over 2 years now. And you know, a lot of that had to do with me coming out as trans, spoiler alert for those of you that didn't know. And a lot of it had to do with just the fact that the 30 years before my dad's death, they played no major role in my life, because my father's family was already fractured and split because of property disputes. And so the fact of the matter is, they never played a major role in my existence for 30 years. And frankly, I can go another 30 years without them. And honestly, my life is a little bit better off without that, right? I don't need that kind of person in my life whose only concern is wealth accumulation and bickering over property, bickering over superficial needs, right? Yes, I want a place to live. Yes, I built my own life out here. And I built that separate from them. I have a life separate from that family. I have a life that family will never understand or be interested in or communicate with me at all. So, you know, when Pele says that, that would be nice to know that kind of existence. That would be nice to have that sort of relationship and understanding of empathy and compassion and love. But that's not the world I came from, and that's certainly not the world Danny comes from, right? And that's not the world I don't think any of us come from. The world we come from is very much fractured, very much split over things like politics, religion, wealth. And I think you could say this cult plays upon that innate desire for empathy and understanding. Or the cult itself is so communal in its nature and structure that it seems appealing to almost all of us. And you can't even say the cult is necessarily evil, because clearly they allow members of the cult to leave, to go have lives of their own, to go experience the world and come back, right? So is it really detrimental to people? Is it really harmful? Or is it just a perspective of coming from such a fractured society that any response to that, where it is a communal relationship, seems alien and seems terrifying? I think that is a question the film doesn't really answer, and it doesn't attempt to, and there's really no need to, because I think the ambiguity is, would you be Danny at the end watching all of your pain, suffering, and hatred burn up in smoke and flames and just smile at the chaos, smile at the catharsis in front of you? I think that is an aspect of the film that Aster purposely left sort of very ambiguous for us to decode. So the reason why this film resonates with me much more now as opposed to when it first came out in 2019 is because during the pandemic, again, like I mentioned, between 2020 and 2022, I experienced a series of devastating losses in the span of a year. I lost my best friend since junior high, Ricardo Sandoval, a remarkable artist, human being, and friend who I, you know, I still miss to this day. I send messages to him on Facebook and Instagram. I know he's never going to read them. But, you know, knowing that I could just express that stuff to him helps me come to terms that he's gone. But, you know, I have trinkets of his. I have memories with him. I miss him. I go visit his grave every time I'm back home because it's the least I can do as someone that loved him. Unfortunately, I couldn't attend his funeral due to COVID restrictions, and that's something I regret. It's something I will never be okay with, but it's something I have to move on and deal with, right? Then in April of 2021, I lost my father after a month-long battle with septic shock, which was brought on by a six-year struggle with leukemia. witnessing the man I loved and the man I had looked up to when I was growing up and admired as a child, the man that, you know, frankly showed me a lot of the movies that I love, Planet of the Apes, Star Wars, Soylent Green, Blade Runner, Alien. You know, my love for cinema, my passion for this art form truly was handed down from him to me as a child. He showed me movies that I probably shouldn't have watched as a child. Thanks for showing me Christine and Maximum Overdrive when I was like 11 years old, Dad. And seeing that individual, seeing that man, you know, endure a painful and slow death kept alive by machines was something I still struggle to come to terms with today. I know deep down that I will always be dealing with it, especially, again, as October marks what would have been his 66th birthday. The decision my older brother, my father's widow, and I had to make to put him in hospice to allow him to pass on, I guess, relatively painless, you know, it fills me with regret. Like in Midsommar, after the ritualistic suicide, it does seem very odd we place our elderly folks in homes, right? In rest homes. I did that with my grandma on my dad's side, and I'm pretty sure my father would have gone the same way, and I'm pretty sure my mom would go the same way. And, you know, we strip them of their dignity, of their purpose, of meaning, and I feel like I did the same to my father. You know, I robbed him of meaning and purpose in a very profound way, because if for better or worse, you know, him being put into hospice wasn't his choice. It was a choice made by me and two other people. And that's a burden we're all going to have to live with. It's a burden that I, as his youngest daughter, have to live with. And, you know, I had to sign a DNR, and I accepted that fact that I had to sign a do not resuscitate order. And, you know, unlike my friend Rick, who I can slowly move on from, my father is one that I can't, and that's just a fact of life. And, you know, it robbed me of that sense of, well, it didn't rob me of anything. It made me realize that I am mortal. I have a finite amount of time. And my parent, my mom, the only parent I have left, right, now has a finite amount of time. And she's pushing 61 this November. She's getting older there too, you know, and in December of 2022, I had to rush back home for a month to deal with her recovering from open heart surgery. And that was very touch and go. And it still was touch and go right up until March, April of this year. And, you know, just recently, as in the past 3 months, has she started really feeling like more of her old self. And obviously she still has trouble every now and then getting the pacemaker properly set. She's still here, but there is that ticking clock in the back of my head of how long now. And that goes back to what I said earlier about sort of our second coming of age. One is the physical and one is the emotional realization that our parents and our loved ones are here only for but a finite amount of time. And, you know, we don't really have control over that. And we're here only for a finite amount of time, and we don't really have control over that. And we can either choose to wallow in existential dread and fear, or we can, like the cult in Midsommar, choose to make meaning out of it by giving our lives and ourselves to other people. And frankly, I would rather give my life and myself to other people that I love than to just be selfish with it forever. You know, I see the appeal of the cult. And it's for that reason I can relate to Danny in that sense, understanding the beauty and allowing someone to have meaning. This is evident in her reaction after the ritualistic suicide. She doesn't seem as shocked as the others, but rather taken in by it. Similarly, during the month-long process of watching my father die, my partner, like Christian, was emotionally isolated from me. They didn't offer any emotional comfort or understanding or even the concept of grief because they had never really lost anyone themselves. So how could you understand grief if you never had to process grief? And, you know, it can poison you. That loss can truly corrupt your soul. And I feel like I am still trying to reclaim myself from that loss. You know, sorry, that's my cat. I have two, by the way. You know, I received similar responses from my siblings, my mother, and even my father's family, like I mentioned earlier. Like Danny, I was forced to suppress my pain. I was forced to hold it in, to hold it back, to not really deal with it. And sometimes I still have arguments with my siblings about, you know, telling me to get over it and that he would be proud of me. Yeah, I know he would be proud of me, but that still does not change the fact that I miss him, right? Him knowing he would be proud of me and knowing he wouldn't want me to cry over him does not change the fact that I miss him. I am always going to miss him, and nothing will change that. And, you know, like I mentioned, Danny is forced to hold herself back, to hold in her grief, which can be seen pretty frequently in the course of the film as she constantly tries to hold back her tears and oftentimes isolates herself, like on the flight to Sweden. She breaks down in the bathroom, and on the bad shroom trip, she isolates herself in the outhouse. The only time she is actually ever allowed to openly express her pain without anyone holding her back, without any false sense of empathy, it's just an earnest, honest expression of all her grief, is after witnessing Christian have sex with one of the women from the cult, which then, of course, leads to the now iconic group breakdown moment so beautifully performed by Florence Pugh in the communal housing chamber, where she just, I think it's like a 3-minute long scene, and it just builds up and it intensifies, and it just, that the camera just breaks in and gets close on her face, and you just see the pain and suffering on Danny. For the first time in the film, openly cries out her grief and pain in seclusion. But this time, she, you know, she's really not alone or isolated. She's allowed to actually express her loss and anger, which is something that sadly still escapes me. And I think will always be out of reach for me, because I don't have any access to a cult like this. You know, I don't come from that world. I come from ours, the one of cold detachment, the one that Pele says everyone bickers over what's theirs and what's yours. That's the world I come from. That's the world we come from. It's one of isolation and fear and just sadness that I don't think we all quite understand. And I think the weirdest way, I don't actually consider Midsommar a horror film. I actually consider it very cathartic and very beautiful in its catharsis. And that's probably very weird for someone to say. I mean, it's graphic, it's grotesque in some scenes, especially in the suicide of the two elders, euthanasia, I guess. It's not really suicide. But it isn't really that horrifying. Really, we don't see anyone die. I think the only time we see someone die is Josh, if I remember correctly, in the temple chambers where he tries to snap photos of their, essentially their sacred texts. And that's it. And then everything else happens off camera. And all we are seeing is just the aftermath of the bodies spread out like a bald eagle or rightfully used as fertilizer. But we don't really see anything too horrific. And you can't even really say the incestuous mutant, the prophet of the cult, is too horrific, right? Because we only get glimpses of him. We don't really see him the whole film. So I can't even really say this film is a horror film in the truest sense of the word. It is maybe a thriller suspense, but it is not horror. Speaking of, so I'm not sure if because of the subject matter that I'm talking about, she wanted to join. But my black cat, Luna, is wanting to be a co-host right now. So don't ask why, but she wanted to join in and wanted to co-host the podcast episode with me because she's so beautiful. That's right. That's right. She's so beautiful. I know I'm wasting time, but whatever. You're listening to me ramble. You can listen to me talk about my cat. I think one of the brilliant ways that this cult manipulates you is by their performance of empathy. If I can say it as I don't really feel like it's performance. I actually do think it's genuine empathy. When Danny discovers Christian with the other girl, the other women wait with her in sympathy while the men cry out in pain as they burn alive at the temple. The group cries with them in their agony. Throughout the entire movie, Danny is alone with absolutely nobody, but Pele recognizes and acknowledges her pain, even going so far as to acknowledging her birthday because her piece of shit boyfriend Christian forgot. And, you know, he draws her that portrait with her and the flower wreath on. Her boyfriend was cold and unfeeling, and his friends made it very clear they don't care about her either, and they sort of reluctantly agree to have her tag along. In the end, she is led to believe she has finally found the people who will cry with her and feel her pain as she does, which is all she ever really wanted in the end. And that, I think, is also just how cults attract people in real life, preying on our animalistic desire to be loved, to be understood, just to be wanted. I can certainly see myself fall prey to such tactics and lifestyles, and I'm sure, you know, despite what we say, we probably all could. And I know I would have just a big ass smile on my face like Danny does at the end of it. A beautiful and horrific catharsis and, you know, sort of this expulsion of pain and grief and suffering and loss that I don't think any amount of therapy could ever match. She witnesses all of that symbolically go up in flames with the fire temple at the end. And, you know, you just see that beautiful, beautiful, honest, sort of profound, insane smile creep across Florence Pugh's face at the end. And it's gorgeous. There's that crescendo with music. And it's just beautiful in the true sense of the word. She is decked out in that gorgeous, gorgeous, well-designed May Queen Fire flower dress that I've seen a lot of people wear at like Comic-Cons, which I think is kind of funny. But it ends on that note, and I absolutely think that was a brilliant choice because there is no real, oh, I feel happy now. She doesn't have like this epilogue with Pele. She doesn't discuss that she feels better. You just know she feels better. And it might have taken a lot of people dying and her boyfriend being burned alive to feel better, but she feels better. And hey, you know, good for her. I wish I had that catharsis. It's better than any therapy out there, I'm sure. So as always, I like to do some just critical reviews of what, you know, obviously people thought about the film when it first came out. And I do think this was a very divisive film. Again, it's probably going to sound like a hot take, but I actually think this is a better structured, better paced, better thought out film than Hereditary. Now, don't get me wrong. I think Hereditary is a great film. It's not necessarily my favorite one. I think the mythos of Hereditary, of the family bloodline, of the witches and all of that is actually very flimsy and clumsy. A lot of what they set up in the early parts of the film don't really pay off towards the end of the film. I could be mistaken. Maybe it might take a third viewing of it. But I do think this film works better than Hereditary does. John DeFore of The Hollywood Reporter described the film as the horror equivalent of Destination Wedding and more unsettling than frightening, but still a trip worth taking. Writing for Variety, Andrew Barker noted that is neither the masterpiece nor the disaster that the film's most vocal viewers are bound to claim. Rather, it is an admirably strange, thematically modeled curiosity from a talented filmmaker who allows his ambitions to outpace his executions, which I kind of don't agree with, because I actually do think, I think Ari Aster's skill matches the kind of films he wants to tell. So I actually strongly disagree with that view. And I actually do think Ari Aster is probably one of the better horror filmmakers. I can't even say he's a horror filmmaker. Better cult, you know, occult thriller filmmakers we have now. Probably in the past good 30, 40 years, because a lot of films can either be very campy, very slashy, or pay direct. Like, if this was a typical film that was trying to pay homage to Wicker Man, right? It would just be a straight homage to Wicker Man. Every scene, every aspect, every bit of dialogue in that kind of film would just be an homage to the Wicker Man. There would be no substance other than, oh, hey, it's the Wicker Man, but for millennial audiences. Midsommar, you can say, is the Wicker Man for millennial audiences, but it's really not, because the themes that it's dealing with are completely opposite of Wicker Man. The impact that this film has on you viscerally and emotionally is different than what you feel when you walk out of watching Wicker Man, put it that way. So I would actually say, in the hands of other directors, this film would be more of a straight homage to the cult horror films of the 70s, like I mentioned earlier. Whereas I think with Aster, it actually is elevated, because there is very few references to other movies within this movie, which I think is rare for a lot of horror movies now, because a lot of horror movies now reference or have homages or have pastiches to other horror films. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but it is definitely stifling creativity. Because I would say there isn't a film really like Midsommar, right? David Edelstein of Vulture praises Pugh's performance as amazingly vivid and noted that Aster paces Midsommar more like an opera than a scare picture, but concluded that the film doesn't gel because its impulses are so bifurcated, which I don't really think is the true, was really the case, because its influences, you know, its impulses are very muted and very tame. Again, there are no murders that really happen on camera in this film. There are the aftermaths of murders, right? And there is quick cuts of someone getting their face smashed in or someone getting hit with a mallet. But those are few and far between. I think the only two murders we actually see are spaced out by like an hour from each other. So there isn't really, you know, other than sort of jump scare visuals when she's having a bad trip where she sees the plants grow out of her hand, there isn't really a lot of blood and guts and slasher. In fact, I would say this film is very, very self-contained in that term. You know, it's a parable of a woman's religious awakening, which I would agree with. That is sort of what The Devils is about. That's also a woman's fantasy of revenge against a man who didn't meet her emotional needs. That's also a male dictator's masculine and masochistic fantasy of emasculation at the hands of a matriarchal cult. And that I actually think is a terrible interpretation, because there is no hint that that cult is either matriarchal or patriarchal in its structure. It is probably the most unisex driven cult you can probably think of, because they worship both the masculine and the feminine simultaneously, and both with reverence. Neither one tops the other, because in their cult, I think there's a deeper understanding that it takes both to essentially keep Mother Nature going, right? It takes the male and it takes the female, and sometimes it takes both, which is why every generation they have that sort of a gender prophet that you know was born out of incest, that can't really biologically reproduce, and that agender prophet is the one that is able to dictate the course of that cult for the next like century. So I wouldn't even say it's a matriarchal cult, because there really isn't a matriarchal figure in that film. The men and women of that cult both have their roles, but also seem to slip in and out of those roles pretty easily, right? neither one is the masculine leader, neither one is the feminine leader. The women don't seem as submissive. The men don't seem as domineering. So I really disagree with that take that it is a matriarchal cult. In fact, I really wonder if they watch the same film, because there's no aspect of Midsommar that feels matriarchal or feels patriarchal. I would say there is a bit of spiritual awakening in it, but it's counter to most spiritual awakenings, right? Dany isn't going on this, like, it's not eat, pray, love. Dany is going inward because she has to, but in that forced journey inward, she's given the opportunity to actually find another way to handle her grief, which is allowing to be sad, allowing to handle that grief, allowing to share that grief with other people. So there is a spiritual awakening, but she's not looking towards a deity or God. She's finding spirituality among other people, because those other people are saying it's okay to be broken and it's okay to not be perfect. You are complete in the sense that you are a human being and you're worthy of being loved, and you're worthy of expressing yourself, and you're worthy of having people be empathetic towards you. And again, can't, like, come on, didn't meet her emotional needs. Like, the dude's a dick, like, and just straight up an asshole. He doesn't meet her emotional needs because he doesn't know how to be emotional. He wanted to break up with her in the first 5 minutes of the film. Like, come on, doesn't meet her emotional needs? I think anyone in their right mind would break up with that dick. Like, that is just, that's how you know that review is written by a man. I'm sorry. I had to say that. You could totally tell this is from a male perspective. In the New York Times, Manoah Dryas was critical of the character's depths behind Dany and Christian, finding them instructively uninteresting and stereotypically gendered as a couple. Now, I wouldn't say they're stereotypically gendered, right? What I would say is they are boring because that is the point of their dynamic. They are not a functioning couple. They're a couple that clearly is on the rocks, is not working out. There's the basis of Christian wanting to break up with Dany already. So we already know from the get of the start of this movie that they are a couple that has had, you know, their best days are behind them, and it's just a rocky path from there. And so I get why they're uninteresting as a couple, because let's be frank about real life. There are plenty uninteresting couples that should have ended a long time ago, right? So I think that is a deliberate choice by Ari and Florence, and just the writing of this film, is to have Dany and Christian be unlikable as a couple, because that's the point of their relationship. That, I think, is a misreading of what that dynamic was supposed to be. They're not in love. That love died a long time ago. That's the point. That's why Dany embraces the cult's empathy at the end of the film, because she didn't get it from the one person who, in theory, should be empathetic towards her, which was her partner for 4 years. Eric Kahn of IndieWire, oh god, IndieWire, summarized the film as a perverse breakup movie, which, yes, I suppose is an accurate depiction of this, adding that Astor doesn't always sink the biggest surprises, but he executes at twisting the knife. That's true. I would say he excels at twisting a knife. He is definitely a master at creating shock value, but not shock for the sake of shock. Each shocking moment in his film sort of has a purpose. You know, after deflowering, that makes Ken Russell's The Devils look tame. Astor finds his way to a strange reality check, which, yeah, I would say this is a startling reality check. At least for Dany it is, because she realizes there is another path. And that path doesn't have to be the one that she was forced into. It's a path that she can choose to embrace and sort of enjoy the madness. And fuck, I would too. Time Out's Joshua Rothkamp awarded the film a 5 out of 5 star rating, writing a savage yet evolved slice of Swedish folk horror. Ari Aster's hallucinatory follow-up to Hereditary proves him a horror director with no peer, which I would agree with. I think, given everything we've seen now, right? Given, you can say Bo is not afraid is kind of, or Bo is afraid is kind of, I wouldn't call it a dumpster fire. I would definitely say it's Astor's attempt to step away out of that genre, but kind of reluctantly falling back into it, because that's all he is that's probably the only genre he could really operate very well in. Like, I don't think he could do action. He certainly couldn't do comedy. horror thriller seems to be his bag, right? I think he's kind of pigeonholed himself in that genre, for better or for worse. I do think Beau Is Afraid was his attempt to step out of that genre, but kind of didn't succeed. With him having no peer in terms of that kind of project, yeah, I would agree. Although I would say Ty West, an entirely different horror filmmaker, mind you, is kind of succeeding in more direct horror slasher homages with like we mentioned yesterday, last week's episode X, with Pearl, which we're going to cover later, and obviously Maxine coming out next year. I would say it is a tie between Ty West and Ari Aster in terms of who's a better horror filmmaker, and I think the jury's still out on that one. I do think Ty West has more commerciality. Sorry if you heard an email. I think Ty West has more commercial aspects and aspirations. I think Ty West is more versatile than Ari Aster is. But I wouldn't say they're one and the same. They're entirely two different filmmakers that have entirely different approaches to the same genre, right? But I would say Aster in terms of subtlety. Like, if there was ever going to be anyone that could remake The Omen and do it right, or remake Rosemary's Baby and do it right, it would be Ari Aster, because those types of films are direct influences to his work. And so in terms of that kind of horror, right, that kind of elevated genre thriller, that I think he succeeds in. In the more commercial thriller slasher aspect, no. We're never going to see Aster direct a Saw 15, right? We're never going to see Aster direct a schlocky horror film. We're never going to get that from Aster, which is great. I want that. But we might get that from Ty West, and it might be fucking amazing because they're two different filmmakers. Conclusion. Although I still think Aster has yet to truly peak, again, Beau Is Afraid is a rather hit or miss, just sort of depends on your taste in film. And in more ways, I think it's, again, his attempt to break free of the thriller horror genre while still dealing with themes of family trauma and emotional distress. It is a lackluster film in comparison to Midsommar, a film that I think is far more put together and coherent than, say, Hereditary is, a film that I think has deep fundamental plot and pacing issues, but that is neither here nor there. We can cover that film at another time. I do need to sit down and rewatch Hereditary again to sort of compare and contrast, and I might do that this month because it is spooky month, so who knows, I might actually do that. But anyways, I hope you enjoyed more of my ramblings on this fantastic piece of cinema, which, if again, if you have not seen, I highly, highly recommend it. In fact, A24 is re-releasing it this month in select cinemas on October 25th with an extra 23 minutes of cut footage, so go enjoy. It's the director's cut, which my ex saw in cinemas without me when I was back home dealing with my dad's stuff, and I was really pissed off by that because I was like, dude, what the fuck. However, I really do not recommend watching this film high. I made that mistake while doing the research for this episode, and that was both a brilliant and deeply weird idea because it left me just like really traumatized, but at the same time, I felt really cathartic after watching it when the fire temple goes up and I'm just sitting there high off my ass smiling with Danny as all of her grief and stress and anxieties and fear just wash away in that fire. And I'm just like, oh, I wish I could have had that. Oh, wait, I do have that, because this movie is oddly enough helping me deal with my grief in very profound and deep personal ways that I didn't really think it would. But I do think the key theme of this film is the catharsis of grief. And I don't really see a lot of people discuss Midsommar in that term, right? They're discussing Midsommar in terms of themes, of tropes, and homages to cult horror films, again, like the aforementioned Wicker Man. But they're not discussing it in a more deep, profound, and personal way, which I think is the best way to read into this film, in that it is a film about grief and loss and coming to terms with it, and that maybe the best way to come to terms with it is embracing the madness that it can cause. Rather than trying to hold it back, we should embrace that. So if anyone has any access to Swedish Midsommar cults, Please let me know. I would love to book a ticket. I have my passport. I wanted to go to Sweden. And I actually do have a midsummer dress and a flower wreath in my closet because I do tend to wear that during June and July, which is the month of midsummer in Swedish culture, which I actually started doing after watching this movie, which says a lot about me. So concludes today's episode on one of the films that helped me overcome so much loss in my recent life and convinced me of the benefits of joining an empathetic cult. Not really, or maybe, who knows. All that said, come join us next week as we take a deep dive into Dario Argento's 1977 three-strip Technicolor Italian nightmare, Suspiria. Which, you have to say it like that, Suspiria. Because I'm a nerd. I've seen that film like twice in theaters and it's fucking amazing. This has been your host, rambling on for the past hour and something minutes, wishing you all a very good week. And as always, I hope you create some art. I hope you fall in love. I hope you watch something new and entertaining and interesting. And I hope of hopes that you're good out there, because I know the world is dark and I know it's scary right now. But if I can provide some insight and enjoyment and knowledge about film and film history and just how I think we can all just talk and relate over a movie, because movies know no language. Even if they are in another language, they don't really have any cultural restrictions, I don't think. I think there are fundamental aspects of human nature that are just universal. Love, pain, grief, fear, anxiety, loss, hope, joy. All of those emotions are purely universal. And given, you know, the war in Ukraine and now the attacks in Israel, I think we need now more so than ever to be reminded to just be empathetic, to just understand each other, to make attempts to understand each other, to, I don't know, try to make the world a better place in any way that we can, because frankly, a lot more people are out there destroying the world than there are people doing good things in it. And I hope we can overcome that. I hope we can, like Midsommar, like Danny, find a better way of operating in the world. And if it means embracing the madness that comes with grief and empathy, then I would rather have that than have this cold, indifferent, militaristic society that is slowly creeping up on us. Not to get too political, but yeah, I don't really see our species making it for much longer if this is the path we keep going down. You would think after 200,000 years of evolution and art and culture and craftsmanship and beauty and music and cinema and photography, that we would find a better way to understand each other. But we haven't. And so I think the reason why I got back into this podcast was because I wanted to share my love with movies and cinema and art and culture with other diverse voices, with other people that I know, with other people that I love and other people that I care about, with other creators, with other positive minds out there. And this is not toxic positivity, clearly not, because I'm talking about embracing your grief. But it is, I guess, embrace the better demons of our nature. Embrace the desire to be empathetic, the desire to understand each other, the desire to be understood. And hopefully, if this podcast helps someone understand someone else just a bit better, then I feel like that's a good thing. If I can bring some goodness to the world in just a tiny iota, then I feel like that's a worthy cause. And so I hope you enjoy this episode, and I hope you go watch Midsommar, and I hope you find some empathy out there in the world. And I hope you find some understanding, because we are all human and we are all deserving of it. So this has been your host, rambling on again, Aaron Escobar, wishing you all a good day, signing off. Thank you.
loneliness is the coat you wear, a deep shade of blue is always there. Place you're in with nothing to lose, but no more to win. I can't go on.